Thanks for listening to Here and Now. We want to know about your experience listening to this podcast, what you like and don't like. If you have suggestions or feedback, send us an email at hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, do President Obama's plans to combat income inequality go far enough? We'll ask Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz.
But first, during the president's State of the Union address last night, he called on Congress to authorize the use of military force to sustain the fight against ISIS and referred to recent terror attacks in Paris and on a crowded school in Pakistan.
We stand united with people around the world who've been targeted by terrorists, from a school in Pakistan to the streets of Paris. We will continue to hunt down terrorists and dismantle their networks, and we reserve the right to act unilaterally, as we have done relentlessly since I took office, to take out terrorists who pose a direct threat to us and our allies.
Let's bring in NPR's Pakistan correspondent Philip Reeves in Islamabad. And Philip, this is a complicated alliance. The U.S. grumbles that it's Pakistan that doesn't do enough to fight the Taliban and al-Qaeda. But among Pakistanis following the president's speech, how do you think his pledge last night was received?
I think that comment is welcome in Pakistan. And the reason I think that is that there was a feeling in Pakistan after the attacks in Paris, that the huge crowds that manifested themselves on the streets of Paris were in stark contrast to what is perceived by some here as having been a rather remote and detached reaction to the atrocity that happened at an army-run school in Peshawar, where 150 people were killed, of which more than 130 were kids. So I think these remarks will be appreciated. That said, in Pakistan, there are people, of course, who will always argue that, militancy and Islamist extremism is rooted in Western foreign policy, and that goes back decades. But I think after the atrocity, particularly in Peshawar, that school, people now, in many cases, are aligning themselves with the victims of these atrocious attacks, and will be very much appreciate the fact that that was acknowledged in the speech today.
Well, so there's the Taliban, there's al-Qaeda, and then there's ISIS, a different group. And again, last night, President Obama said that he wanted Congress to extend an authorization for him to fight ISIS in Syria. But what is the nexus of ISIS in Pakistan, and how might the conversation about ISIS be received there?
It's an issue of considerable concern amongst people in the security establishment. For the last couple of months, signs have been popping up on the landscape that ISIS, the Islamic State, is in some way involved or active in Pakistan. And that could merely be expressions of support. There has been graffiti in support of ISIS that has cropped up in the mega city, the port city of Karachi. There have been a few commanders from the Pakistani Taliban who have overtly expressed allegiance to the Islamic State. And all eyes are also on what role ISIS may be having in neighbouring Afghanistan. And if ISIS, as some fear, becomes a significant force within Afghanistan, especially in the south, then that's something that Pakistani authorities would be deeply concerned about.
Of course, last night the president said that tonight, for the first time since 9/11, our combat mission in Afghanistan is over, but few doubt that there will still be combat among the U.S. troops that are there to train Afghan troops, and with an authorization to launch airstrikes if necessary. So people are calling that claim into question. But I want to ask you, the U.S. use of unmanned aerial vehicles, drones, came up in the president's speech. Let's listen.
As Americans, we respect human dignity even when we're threatened, which is why I have prohibited torture and worked to make sure our use of new technology like drones is properly constrained.
Philip, the UK-based Bureau of Investigative Journalism recently estimated that since 2009, the CIA has led 330 covert drone strikes in Pakistan. The rate of civilian deaths is falling, but civilians still being killed. So talk about his comment on drones.
Well, every time there's a drone attack that's ascribed to the United States within Pakistan's sovereign territory, there is a complaint from the Pakistani government. The truth is that the situation is rather more ambivalent than that. You do meet Pakistanis who, when you talk with them more privately, will tell you that they rather favour drones because they can't see any other immediately effective way of tackling mobilised militants who are in a landscape where there aren't an awful lot of choices. And it should be pointed out that the reason that civilian casualties have come down might, in at least in part, be connected by the fact that they have, out of the tribal belt, particularly North Waziristan, decanted nearly a million people in order to allow the Pakistani army to go in there and try to crush the Taliban and their allies who've been in that area for ages, using it as a haven. So those people have been moved out and they're now internally displaced people within Pakistan. And that in itself presents a problem for the people who are trying to govern this country.
That's NPR's Philip Reeves, listening in on the President's State of the Union from his perch in Islamabad, Pakistan. Philip, thank you so much.
You're most welcome.
Well, much of the president's speech last night had to do with the economy. He posed several questions to Congress, not least of which on the topic of income inequality.
Will we accept an economy where only a few of us do spectacularly well? Or will we commit ourselves to an economy that generates rising incomes and chances for everyone who makes the effort?
The president laid out a progressive economic agenda, higher taxes on the rich, free universal community college, guaranteed sick leave, and several other proposals that are probably unlikely to see the light of day in a Republican Congress. But what if they did? What would they mean for income inequality? Joseph Stiglitz is a Nobel Prize winning economist and professor at Columbia University. He's with us now. Joseph Stiglitz, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
Well, first, I want to play another clip of the president. Here he is saying that the economic crisis is over.
Tonight, we turn the page. Tonight, after a breakthrough year for America, our economy is growing and creating jobs at the fastest pace since 1999.
Now, on the same day of the speech, you published an op-ed that said the world economy, including the U.S., is still suffering, stuck in the same rut since emerging from the 2008 financial crisis. What do you think of then what the president was saying?
Well, I think he's absolutely right that things have been going much better in the United States than they have been, and certainly much better in the United States than, say, in Europe. But when I look at data like what's happened to incomes, wages of ordinary Americans, when I look at macroeconomic data like the labor force participation rate, which is as low as it's been in 40 years, I say we are still far from back to what you might call a normal economy.
Well, if that's the case, are what the president was proposing last night the kinds of proposals that you would like to see to combat income inequality, or is it just a day late and a dollar short?
Well, I think they're all moves in the right direction, except for one, but they're not going far enough. So, for instance, he talked about the importance of education, absolutely right. He talked about importance of getting more women into the labor force, providing child care, maternity leave. Again, absolutely right. He talked about a more progressive tax system. Again, something absolutely right. But consider the tax reforms that they're talking about. They're proposing increasing the capital gains tax and eliminating a technical provision that allows the very rich to essentially totally escape taxes on capital gains. He's only raising the capital gains tax rate to 28%. He hasn't explained to the American people why those who speculate on land should and make profits from that speculation should be taxed at a lower rate than those who work for a living.
Well, what do you think the rate should be then?
I think the capital gains should be taxed at exactly the same rate as somebody who works for a living, earning a wages. No reason to give an exemption. There might be some national priorities like adapting to global warming, creating new enterprises. So if they have some particular objectives, that's one thing that we ought to debate. But I can tell you one thing, taxing land at a lower rate, the returns on land, isn't going to create more land. This is not going to create a stronger economy, not going to create more jobs. And no one has shown that this preferential treatment of capital gains leads to a stronger economy. What we have shown is that it leads to enormous increases in inequality, with those at the very top paying lower taxes than those that are whose income is not so high, a regressive tax system.
Joseph Stiglitz, you said that there was one thing you didn't like, and I'm assuming that's the trade policies.
That's right. You got it.
Explain. Why do you think that is bad for the American economy or bad for the middle class?
Well, the president, again, didn't really explain why he thought it was good. The usual assumption is that we gain jobs by exporting more. But any trade agreement is going to be a balanced trade agreement. We may export more, but we will also import more. In equilibrium, exports and imports are going to be balanced. But if exports create jobs, imports destroy jobs. And the jobs that we tend to have in our export sector, those sectors tend to be very capital intensive, not with many jobs. And the import sectors, the sectors that we will be hurting, are sectors where very labor intensive. And we now know from research that in those parts of the country where there has been a surge of imports, wages are lower and jobs are weak.
But can we really wall ourselves off? Don't we have to compete on the global stage?
We do. And that's why structuring a good trade agreement would be good. But that's not what the U.S. trade representative is engaged in doing. Much of what is the irony of the current trade negotiation, one of their objectives is to increase drug prices, just the opposite of Obamacare, which was trying to get health care costs down.
Right.
They're trying to make it more difficult for generics, which provide important competition, more difficult for governments in other countries to regulate the exorbitant prices of drugs. You ask, what does this have to do with trade, fair trade, increasing jobs? It has nothing to do with that. It's intended to increase the coffers of the pharmaceutical industries. And
well, we got to leave it there, Joseph Stiglitz, but we really appreciate your thoughts on the president's speech last night. Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize-winning economist at Columbia. Thank you.
Thank you.
And right now, more than 100,000 people in the U.S. are waiting for a kidney transplant. That's a longer waiting list than for any other organ. And each year, only about one out of six of those patients will get a new kidney. Who's next in line is a delicate and high-stakes question, and the answer has recently changed. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, WCPN in Cleveland's Joanna Richards explains.
Matching patients with donor organs is a complex process with medical, ethical, and practical considerations. But there are still often many potential matches for each available kidney. So how to decide who gets it?
We, of course, prioritize prior living donors. We prioritize pediatric patients.
That's Mark Ader, a transplant surgeon at University Hospital's Case Medical Center in Cleveland. He's vice chair of the Kidney Transplantation Committee at UNOS, the United Network for Organ Sharing. UNOS oversees all U.S. transplants, and Ader says his committee came up with a better way to allocate kidneys to needy patients. The changes took effect last month. Ader says most patients won't see much of a change in wait time, but for some, the new rules will make a dramatic difference.
Everything about football is important.
Mike Brown and his mom, Vicky Brown, talk football on a game night at her home near Cleveland. A dozen relatives dig into chicken, pies, and homemade onion rings.
I'm from Cleveland, so I'm a diehard Browns fan. I have to show love for the Dallas Cowboys.
Along with football and family, Mike Brown loves to act. He's in college full-time and has a part-time job with the Cleveland Indians baseball team. He has to fit all of that around what amounts to his other part-time job, dialysis.
Okay, celebrity Mike, come on.
At his dialysis center, Brown settles into an easy chair next to a boxy machine he relies on to do the work his kidneys don't. He looks away as the nurse inserts two needles into his forearm, one to take the blood out, one to bring it back in. In between, the machine cleans it of waste and removes excess fluid.
This is where I was sick for the next 4.5 hours.
Brown, who's 31, has been coming for dialysis 3 times a week for nearly 12 years. Afterward, he's drained and can't do much.
You have to plan an entire day around doing this.
But earlier this month, because of the policy changes at the United Network for Organ Sharing, Brown moved years ahead on the transplant waiting list. As you might expect, with hearts and lungs, people most likely to die soon without one are given first priority for transplants. But kidneys are different, because dialysis, though burdensome, can keep patients alive. So kidneys are largely first come, first served. Brown could have gotten on the waiting list more than a decade ago when he got sick, but he says the thought of surgery scared him. 3 years ago, his new doctor insisted he reconsider. He would likely live better and longer with a transplant. So Mike Brown got in line. Under the old rules, it would be a few more years before a kidney might become available. Ader of UNOS says patients with earlier and better medical care often get listed sooner.
We find that not everybody had the same opportunity for listing at an equivalent time.
That's because to get on the waiting list, a patient has to be plugged into the healthcare system. Usually a doctor acts as an advocate, helping to navigate the process. Jeff Kahn is a bioethicist at Johns Hopkins and used to work with UNOS, including on kidney policy. He says what that means is when a patient gets listed might have nothing to do with how long they've been sick. It might just signal how quickly they got to a good doctor.
It's reflective of the disparities that exist across our healthcare system.
Kahn says the new policy aims to level the playing field. The way patients get listed is the same, but once they're listed, their waiting time is measured back to when they started dialysis. So, Ader says Brown is now likely to get a new kidney within the next 6 months. Along with making the system more equitable, UNOS also wanted to maximize use of a scarce resource by better matching patients and organs based on their likely longevity. Kahn says there was concern that organs from donors who were young and healthy when they died were too often going into older, sicker recipients. Then when they died, their kidneys' years of potential utility were lost.
So you can make an argument that from an ethics perspective, it was an irresponsible use of that resource.
On the other hand, always matching kidneys in patients with the longest life expectancies would penalize older and sicker people.
That seems to cut against one of the reasons we want to transplant people, right? We wanted to transplant them because their health is in jeopardy.
Kahn says UNOS' new policy seems aimed at a sweet spot, what he calls a balance between equity and utility. Back at the dialysis center, Mike Brown says he got his first phone call about a potential kidney match just a week after the changes kicked in.
I was excited. I was almost in tears.
He was one of a handful of patients put on standby.
You know, I have to think about, God, what, you know, what would it be like not to have to do this every other day of my life?
Brown ended up losing out to someone higher on the waiting list. But he knows it's a good sign. It'll be his turn soon. For Here and Now, I'm Joanna Richards in Cleveland.
Well, let's take a few minutes now, Robin, to acknowledge Deflategate, the controversy over whether the New England Patriots intentionally deflated footballs in their blowout playoff win against the Indianapolis Colts on Sunday.
I think the word you're looking for, Jeremy, is cheating. Did they cheat? And while the NFL gets to the bottom of this, we've got questions for Only a Game's Doug Tribou. So, Doug, first of all, why would the Pats cheat? I mean, deflate a ball. Why would they do that? Why would someone do that?
Well, it would make it easier to grip, and therefore it makes it easier to throw and catch. So it would give some advantage to the quarterback. And the precision is so required in that position now. The throws have to be just right. It's a very much a feel thing. And that would be the advantage there. And couldn't we have named it something different, like the air affair? Does it always have to be gate?
Well, here's the other big question. I think a lot of people who play other sports may wonder this. How does it work with the teams providing their own footballs?
Well, this has sort of been a revelation of this whole thing, that each team provides 12 balls for each game. When there's bad weather, they provide more than that. Each team will bring 24 balls. And there's differences between how the balls are treated. They're checked by officials, but then they're put back into these bins. They're marked so that other balls can't get into the rotation. The official looks at the ball every time they use it. But there are different balls for special teams, because kicking a ball that was inflated differently would be a different issue. So it's a surprisingly complex process.
And if you wanted to deliberately deflate the balls, you'd have to get around all that. Has ball tampering happened before in the NFL?
Well, there's all these other things that are coming out now. You know, Minnesota and Carolina played a game where it was 12 degrees, and they were warned by the NFL not to heat up footballs, and they did it anyway. The Fox cameras caught them heating up the balls, and the NFL said, we warned you, and we're going to warn you to do it, not do it again next week. So there's all kinds of sort of ball issues
here.
Well,
we could have Inflategate, because Green Bay Packer quarterback Aaron Rodgers says he likes to use overinflated footballs. You'd think they'd bounce more, but that's what he'd like. Look, let's face it. The Patriots have a reputation for cheating. The team and coach Bill Belichick were fined a total of $750,000 in 2007 for videotaping the defensive signals of the New York Jets. That was Spygate, now Deflategate. Your thoughts. Is it legitimate?
Well, I think it's fair to say, hey, we want to know that everything is on the up and up when these games happen. And it's all of this sort of trickery and these little things sort of distract from the quality of the game. It is worth noting that the Patriots beat the Colts 45-7.
So note it's not that again. Like, why don't you note that again?
So it's not like that game's outcome was in question. But I do think you don't want to be talking about rules violations heading into the biggest sporting event of the year.
Listeners in Indianapolis and Seattle, you may weigh in at our website hereandnow.org. Doug Trabue with NPR's Only a Game. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Walmart is jumping into the tax business. The box retailer says this tax season, customers can skip the check in the mail or the direct deposit and pick up their cash refunds at Walmart stores, no charge for the service. Walmart says the offer is for customer convenience, but of course it means customers will conveniently be in Walmart with cash in hand. CNN's Maggie Lake is in New York. Hi, Maggie.
Hi there, Robin.
And tell us more about this plan. How much will they give out? How do you apply?
Yeah, and do you need anything? You basically can just go in. You don't have to have a particular Walmart account, or you don't have to purchase something or be a sort of frequent visitor. But you do have to have your taxes done at one of the 25,000 outside tax preparers that are partnering with Walmart to offer this refund option. It's something they're calling direct to cash. Walmart itself, as you mentioned, isn't charging for it. There may be a nominal fee coming from some of these tax preparers, but it should be pretty small, something under $10. The thing that you're going to want to watch for, though, is that you're going to still have to pay that usual fee that you would to have an accountant prepare and file your taxes, which is going to vary depending on how complicated they are. The average, usually somewhere around $250. If you have a more simple one with no deductions, going to be closer to $100. But you are still going to have to incur that cost, even though the service itself is free from Walmart.
Well, and Walmart says they're going to cap the refunds up to $7,500. Now, you know, people may want that money deposited in a bank account. So who is Walmart appealing to? Who would want this?
This is really focused for people who do not have a traditional bank account. If you do, the cheapest, most cost-effective thing for you to do is still file yourself, especially if it's online, or go to a person and have it direct deposited. That's your cheapest option. This, though, if you do not have a traditional bank account, you don't have that option. So this is – and that affects a lot of people. Somewhere close to, I think the estimate is 10 million people tend to be low income. And if you don't have a bank account, if you get that paper check in the mail, which sometimes there's a fee for, you then have to go to these cash checking services. Mm-hmm. And the cost there, the fees there can be sky high, a percentage of your overall refund. So compared to that option, the Walmart refund does look attractive. I will say that in some states, they're introducing being able to put on a prepaid debit card. It's not everywhere. It's a handful of states. You can go to the IRS website and check it out. But be careful there, too, because some of those prepaid debit cards have fees as well that you're going to have to want to watch out for.
Well, so it does seem as if Walmart is offering a real service to some people who would need it. But there's also people pointing out, as we just did, that, but wait, there are going to be people standing in the stores with cash.
And how dangerous is that? And in some cases, a lot of cash in their pocket. And this is where you have to really, you know, introduce your fiscal discipline to yourself. And that's the motivation. And Walmart's being really upfront about it. They're like, listen, it doesn't hurt to have our customers standing there with money in their pocket. I think it's also a recognition on the part of Walmart. They understand who their core consumer is. And they tend to be people who are on the lower end of the income scale. It's not all of them. They do recognize that they often do have trouble accessing banks. So I think that that is legitimate. And the other thing thing is, let's remember, Walmart has been struggling. Even though last quarter wasn't bad, maybe they did okay through the holidays. We're going to find out soon. They are under siege from all sorts of other discounters, the dollar stores, online retailers. They're trying to figure out a way to differentiate themselves. What can they offer their customers that you can't find online? And we're increasingly seeing that this idea of one-stop shopping, not only for your cereal and your goods and your dish detergent, but also for healthcare, for financial services, this might be something that's attracted to their customers and help them stand out from the pack.
Now, last year, Walmart started offering mobile checking accounts to customers. So we'll check back with you to see how this foray into banking and finance is going for Walmart down the road. CNN's Maggie Lake, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
It's Here and Now, and let's get more reaction now to President Obama's State of the Union address from Senator John Thune, Republican of South Dakota. He joins us from Washington. Senator Thune, welcome.
Thanks, Jeremy. Good to be with you.
So the president said the shadow of crisis has passed and the State of the Union is strong. Do you agree with that?
Well, look, I mean, I think we've weathered a lot of adversity, there are some good things happening out there, but we're a long ways from out of the woods. There's an awful lot of, in terms of domestic policy, the economy, foreign policy, the world continues to be a very dangerous place, and you can just pick up the newspaper today or any other day and see that. So there's a lot of work ahead of us. I think the president in a State of the Union speech always likes to tout his accomplishments, but it's a far cry from where we need to be, and I hope that he'll be willing to work with the Congress in the months ahead in order to put policies in place that will make America stronger and safer and more prosperous.
What about economically? How are your constituents in South Dakota doing right now? Are they, as the president said, doing much better than obviously 5 years ago, 6 years ago during the crisis?
Well, I think one of the things that the president, you know, points out is that the unemployment rate is down, true, but what they call the labor participation rate, which is the number of people who are working as a percentage of those who could be, is the lowest level in 36 years. And in fact, if the lower labor participation rate was today what it was when the president took office, the unemployment rate today would be 9.9%. That's how many people have dropped out of the labor force. So, and I think the other thing that you know gets lost in all this is wage levels are really flat. In fact, median household income's down about $3,000 from the time the president took office. So, I guess the point is, even though you can look statistically and say, yes, things seem to be improving, which is great, there are still a lot of people who aren't feeling it. Now,
so do you think then that the middle class needs the help that the president is proposing?
Well, I think the middle class always needs help. And you know, our focus, the Republican majority, is to create jobs, grow the economy, and a stronger middle class with better wages, better paying jobs. But I think the way you get there will be a difference of opinion about that. The president last night laid out a prescription that involves an awful lot of government. It's a lot of higher taxes, more spending, and a lot more programs that he wants to launch. It was a very ambitious but a very expensive agenda. And I think most of us believe that the best way to get the middle class lifted in this country is by a vibrant, growing economy that is creating better paying jobs. And what kind of policies can we put out there that would accomplish that?
Well, what kind of policies would you like to put out there as Republicans to accomplish that, besides doing what the president is talking about, which is basically to raise taxes on the wealthy in order to pay for some of these programs you're talking about and lower taxes on the middle class?
You know, my view, Jeremy, is that instead of the president's idea, basically, is to take from some, give to others, essentially, you know, redistribute the pie. I think you want to make the pie bigger. And the way you do that is you've got to have pro-growth policies, policies that will grow the economy and create those better-paying jobs. What is that? Well, that's a tax reform that lowers rates, makes us more competitive in the global marketplace, a trade policy, trade bill. The president did talk about that last night. That's an area where I think there's some common ground where we can work with him. Lessening the heavy hand and cost of regulation in the economy, which is really having a chilling effect on investment and job creation. And, you know, and lower energy costs, which right now we're benefiting from because of fuel prices. But I think that, you know, keeping the cost of healthcare, energy, education down, creating those better paying jobs that are raising wages for people in this country, and that some of the things that I mentioned, I think that we need to do to get there. I think it's a very different way of reaching that ultimate goal than what the president laid out last night. And frankly, I mean, I a lot of people, particularly on his side of the aisle, probably agree with a lot of those things, but it was a very government-heavy speech about the things that government can do for you rather than, okay, if we get the right policies in place and the free enterprise system and free markets and economic freedom in this country, I think that it would really unleash a lot of economic growth. And that ultimately is the way to lift all the boats.
Well, you've talked about wages. What do you think about his idea of raising the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour? He talked about the idea that at the current minimum wage, you might have a family living on $15,000 a year, which is not easy.
Well, and people can't do that. You can't live on that. But, you know, the other thing is you can't live on zero. And, you know, the one thing the Congressional Budget Office and everybody else who studied it has said is that the president's proposal on minimum wage would cost us up to 1 million jobs. People are going to lose jobs as a result of that. And I've talked to both Republican and Democrat small business owners in my home state of South Dakota who pointed out that their ability to hire workers really is, you know, when you start raising that, you raise the cost, that gets translated all the way through the food chain. And and the other thing I guess I would say about that is I would prefer really that be a state issue. The state of South Dakota had that on the ballot this year, and it was raised. People voted to raise it. And rather than having, a sort of a one-size-fits-all solution coming out of Washington, D.C.
Did you support that raise in South Dakota?
Well, I wasn't in favor of it in South Dakota either because, again, one of the things that we talked about, as I heard from a lot of the small businesses across the state, is the impact it was going to have ultimately on jobs. But, I think that the people of South Dakota spoke on that issue. It was an issue that was decided at the state level, and I think that's a more appropriate place to have that discussion rather than having Washington, D.C. decide that for states. I mean, every state's different, and the economies of the states are different. Obviously, we're a lot of small businesses in South Dakota, and, anytime you put these things in place, these mandates by the government, it does have, they're not without consequence. There is an effect that comes with that. And in many cases, it means fewer jobs, and that's not good for anybody.
Let me ask you about foreign policy. The president said he wants Congress to authorize the use of force against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. Right now, the administration is relying on the authorization for the use of military force that was passed back in 2001 after the 9/11 attacks. Would you vote for a new authorization?
Well, yeah, depending on what it looked like. I mean, I think that we probably need to update it. And I frankly believe that he has the authority based on that original authorization to do what he's doing now. But I think that it's a different time. The political consensus in the country is probably different, and it's probably time for us to have that discussion and have that vote again. But I hope the president will send something up that lays out a plan, lays out a strategy for how we're going to win, how we're going to degrade and destroy ISIS and other terrorist threats out there. And, so far, that's not something he's done. But I think that he indicated last night he believes we need to do that, and I hope that he'll send us a plan.
Senator John Thune, Republican from South Dakota. And are you running for president, Senator?
No, I am not.
Definitely not? Not going to happen?
Well, Jeremy, I always tell people you never say never in politics. I didn't think I'd be doing what I'm doing today. But right now I'm focused on my work in the Senate.
All right, John Thune, thank you so much.
All right, good being with you. Thanks.
Last night in his State of the Union address, President Obama brought up once again income inequality, the growing gap between rich and poor American families. What about the income gap within families, the sibling income gap? Psychotherapist Jana Malamud-Smith was quoted in the New York Times saying in 35 years of practice, she'd never seen so many siblings troubled by the difference between their lives and their siblings' lives because of income, even when the wealthier siblings helped out. Dalton Conley, sociologist and professor at New York University, wrote the book on this. Literally, it's called The Pecking Order, A Bold New Look at How Family and Society Determine Who We Become. It was published back in 2004 and considered groundbreaking then. Dalton Conley joins us now from the NPR studios in New York. And Professor, so you wrote this back in 2004. Are you hearing more now about inequity between and among siblings?
I am. I mean, ever since 2004, inequality, with a brief blip after 2008, has been rising. Part of that is going to rear its head within families as well as across families. So you're going to get more sibling inequality. And it's kind of a two-edged sword. You don't want it to be all between families so that we live in a caste society. But there's a cost to it being within families. That means more mobility, that which family you come from means less in terms of where you end up on this really wide ladder. On the other hand, it tears families apart and creates the resentments that you were talking about.
You've said one of the piercing effects of sibling inequity is that if it's someone outside your family who is super successful, you can always assign that success to an inheritance, for instance. But when it's within families, it's a little harder to grasp why one sibling is doing better than the other.
Exactly. It doesn't really begrudge me that much that Warren Buffett or Bill Gates or Mike Bloomberg are so rich. They came from a different background, a different family. They have a different set of advantages or disadvantages. But when I look at my sister or my brother, who really had the same advantages and disadvantages as I did, and they're doing so much better than I am, it really is challenging to my esteem and identity.
They can feel particularly judged.
Exactly. Yeah. And H.L. Mencken a long time ago said that a rich man is somebody who makes $50 more than his wife's brother, or maybe it was his sister's husband, one of those. And we compare ourselves within our local social unit, if you will. And that's why sibling inequality hurts and really has consequences. For example, in families where there are greater disparities between siblings, there's less cohesion. They see each other less. They socialize with each other less. They rely on each other less. The less advantaged sibling tends to have the burden of, for example, elder care more than the more economically advantaged sibling and so forth.
And that's interesting because, as you point out in your research, they tend to be at home or nearer to the parent than the sibling that's successful. Of course, some would argue that didn't play out in their families. But you also, I want to delve back because you also said that within families, it's assumed that siblings have pretty much the same advantages. But you counter that with your own research. Talk about what you found, for instance, about the middle child.
In two-kid families, birth order doesn't really affect socioeconomic success. But in larger families, the kids that are in the middle, that are fighting the two-front war for parental attention and resources, tend to be the most disadvantaged. Of course, there's a million exceptions to all these things. These are averages at the population level.
Well, let's look at some of those averages. You say the chances that a second child will attend private school after the first did drop by 25% with the birth of a third. In other words, there are family resources that are taken into account when it comes to second and third children.
Exactly. So love is not a pie. My mother always used to tell me, but basically everything else that parents and family members have to offer children is a pie. You know, we can just deny that, but that's not going to change the reality that it's going to be harder to send your second or third kid to private school, even if you sent your first one to private school, once more kids are on the scene and more financial expenses appear.
And there are things like divorce that change a family's status. But how much did you find technology is impacting sibling disparity? I'm thinking 30 years ago, the child, maybe the oldest, who chose to continue the family manufacturing business might have been the one that was thought to be on the better track. But then another sibling who opted for a high-tech startup might have zoomed past them.
I think the role of technology in generating sibling inequality is basically the same as it is in generating inequality overall in society. A lot of economists hold technology as the main culprit for rising inequality in the United States and globally, for that matter, because folks were able to take advantage of high-tech jobs, for example, coders and, of course, internet entrepreneurs, are just really raking it in. But people left out of that for their skill set or for whatever reason, luck, they are, you know, stuck in the middle or stuck, you know, with stagnant wages. And that's really what's a lot of what's driving inequality in the world. And that's in the family is no exception. A lot of sibling inequality has to do with different career paths like that.
Well, the New York Times talks about a family equally smart. One chose to be a teacher, an honorable profession. Another went into high tech and boom, there was the split. You said earlier that you've seen this rip families apart. We're thinking that it's not just that siblings maybe can't socialize if they don't have the same economic means, but then the cousins don't either. What else do you see?
One of the strongest patterns I saw was that when a new family forms, when you get married or live with somebody, cohabit, and let's say have your own kids, you tend to socialize with the family of the spouse to which you most resemble. What I mean by that is, let's say I am a professor and I marry somebody who's an attorney. Let's say our class backgrounds are very different, so that attorney came from, you know, a family of white shoe lawyers, and I came from a working class family. So I'm the sibling outlier in my case. Then we're going to be spending more Christmases and Thanksgivings with my spouse's family. We're going to spend more time with, you know, the extended family, to which there's less sibling disparity.
Well, and just speaking of differences, you also point to race, that increasingly with adoptions and intermarriages, siblings have different racial experiences.
Exactly. So it doesn't have to be just, you know, cases of adoption or biracial families and, you know, blended families. Even with kids from the same two parents, there's a pigmentocracy, particularly within minority communities, where skin tone is an important predictor within families. So if you compare the lighter skin sibling with the darker skin sibling in a black family, for example, on average, the lighter skin sibling will be the more successful one economically.
Yeah. Look, in our recent Pew survey, October, 24% of respondents said the reason for the wealth gap is some people just work harder than others. But when it comes to siblings, after all your research, do you think that's true? I would say I don't. I think luck and the field you happen to pick is pretty important. What did the families tell you?
Well, I was expecting to find something like this mother's brother's routine. Mom always loved you best, and everyone blaming what the parents did for their own position or crediting it in the case of the more successful ones. But what I found surprised me, which was that everybody agreed. All the siblings, they might have disagreed about a lot of things, but they agreed about who was the black sheep and who was the golden child. And even the black sheep took it upon themselves. They internalized this narrative of in America that, you know, it's your own fault or it's hard work or you're homeless. They blamed themselves. They said, yeah, you know, I really got the short end of the stick from my parents, but I kind of deserved it because I was always pushing their buttons. I was always making trouble, you know, rather than seeing that these are bigger patterns that are kind of pressing in on the family.
Huh. Well, you leave us with that provocative thought. Dalton Conley, sociologist and professor at New York University. His book is The Pecking Order, A Bold New Look at How Family and Society Determine Who We Become. And from his perch, economic inequity between siblings has grown as inequity across the board has grown. Dalton, professor, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
So fight the family narrative. There's more going on. And Jeremy, thoughts on sibling income inequity are coming in. Here's one. I can't imagine my sibling working hard and barely getting by. That would just be such a sad thought. Let us hear yours at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.